everyone. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. I'm your host, Megan Henry, and today I'm joined by my esteemed colleague, Jose Gonzalez. Hi, Jose. How are you?
Hey, Megan. How are you doing?
Good. I'm so happy you decided to join me today. It took a little, you know, I had to twist your arm a little bit. Like, oh, podcast, what do I have to do?
I'm glad to join.
I'm so happy. And since I've come over to Cruiser Mitchell, I've been trying to pull other people to come join me for the podcast. And you were like actually the first one to volunteer to be a co-host with me. So thank you for that.
Props to the Los Angeles office.
Yes. And you can report to everybody else that it's not scary. In fact, no, it's kind of fun. Well, today we're joined by Jacob Marino. And Jacob is the VP of Claims at Qualitas Insurance Company. And they are a carrier for commercial trucking, but also mostly trucks that cross the border between Mexico and the United States. And I had talked to him on the phone a few weeks ago, and he and I had like an hour-long conversation. I was just fascinated by the types of claims he sees. And it goes hand-in-hand with a lot of stuff that I handle a lot of commercial trucking, and you handle a lot of commercial trucking. So it was just an immediate fit to have you come on and join me. And since you're in the Los Angeles office, and a lot of the stuff that he sees is in California and Texas and in your neck of the woods. So it just made a lot of sense. So with that, we'll bring him in.
This is the Claims Never Sleep podcast, presented by Cruiser Mitchell, with your host, Megan Henry.
Good morning, Jacob. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. How are you today? I'm so happy to have you.
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
I'm thrilled, and Jose's joining me today as well. It's the first podcast for him too, so welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Jacob, you know, I know you're not familiar with this show because it's new, and we're just recording and releasing episodes now, but I've done a similar podcast for some time, and I like to start it off by talking to all my guests about how they got to where they are, because everyone's story is a little bit different, either how you got into claims or how you decided to go to law school or become an attorney. Very few of us, myself included, were one of those people who like knew this is the path I was going to end up taking. I kind of ended up here accidentally. I love hearing everyone's stories. So you are an attorney, but was that something you wanted to do, or were your parents attorneys, or was it something that you kind of fell into?
Yeah, definitely something I fell into. I mean, like as a kid, I wasn't the one that, oh, I want to be a lawyer. Like I wanted to be a fireman or an astronaut or something with a sense of adventure. And even in undergrad, like I started as an early childhood education major. I wanted to be a teacher. And then kind of stumbled into meeting somebody who worked at an insurance company in Fort Worth, Texas, and thought I'd be a good claims adjuster. And I was 22 at the time and seemed like a good idea because it was a real job with a steady paycheck. And so I said, yeah, let me give that a shot. So kind of got thrown in the claims department, and this was back in 2002, and got my license and did personal lines claims for about 5 years, some personal auto, and that sort of introduced me to like the lawyer world, dealing with just represented claimants pre-suit and negotiating with plaintiff lawyers. And I thought, well, maybe I could do that. And then the same person who thought I would be a good adjuster said, well, yeah, you know, have you thought about law school? And I was like, no, not really. But he's like, well, you know, maybe you should. So it's a good mentor. And so I quit working, went to school full time for 3 years and finished in 2010, which was not the best time to be graduating from law school. Yeah. Like all those first year associate jobs were just non-existent. And so my now wife and I, on a whim, moved to Portland, Oregon from Fort Worth, Texas, sort of a dream and a prayer that things are going to work out. And the first job I found was a contract job with a commercial carrier in Portland. And that introduced me to the world of CGL claims. And so that was really a good experience and good education. I was with that company for 5 years and did a lot of like slip and falls, dram shop, premise liability cases. And from there, wanted to kind of get into management. So got a role in Austin, Texas, with a TPA that got me managing claims, and then bounced around a little bit to, I lived in Cincinnati for 2 years, worked for a broker, and then got on with a carrier doing more major case unit type work for a couple years. And about 2 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago, a recruiter reached out to me about my current role. They were looking to fill a position, kind of running a department. And so this was a VP level role. And it was kind of the next evolution of where I wanted to go. And so I've been here for 2 years. In the meantime, like, I did go back and get an LLM in insurance law to kind of help further my knowledge of how I view it as like the business side of insurance. Got a lot of claims experience, obviously, but really wanted to understand the other side just more than underwriting. Like, how is the money managed? How do insurance companies make money? And what do they do multi-line versus single line? So that was a great way to sort of get a lot of knowledge that people spend a long time just through experience getting. And so I could kind of take that to help me grow in my career. But yeah, definitely just ended up by some good luck and taking advantage of some unique opportunities that were put in front of me. And now I've got a department of about 50 people spread out in about 4 states and 2 countries, including Tijuana, Mexico. So it's pretty exciting. Like, it's a great place to be.
I know when you graduated, you said the market wasn't the best. And I graduated around that time too. That's why I'm in litigation, because I couldn't get a job doing anything other than litigation, because it was the only thing that was hiring at the time. But did you make an active choice to stay in insurance, or did you opt out to trying out private practice for some time? I don't blame you for going the way you did. I think skipping the whole billable hour part was probably really wise, but I didn't know if that was a conscious decision on your part.
Through law school, I kept my adjuster's license active. I've had this thing for 5 years. I don't want it to lapse. Maybe it's going to have some value. And then my last semester in undergrad, I took sort of as an elective insurance law, because I thought, oh, this should be an easy A. Then it was, fortunately. Like, it should have been, right?
Nice.
But really, like, I did apply. I had one interview with a firm in Portland, and in the night of graduation from school, like, you have this great day, you know, finish law school, go home, check my mail. And I had a rejection letter from that firm. And then they ended up being a firm that we worked with at the carrier I worked for in Oregon. So it was like, the tables have turned. Not really.
Yeah, that's right.
You're like, maybe I'm not going to give you the next file.
Yeah, so it was really hilarious in that aspect. But I remember what I loved about that first job, and it was Argo, like, I can say the name. It was Argo out of Portland. I was handling, on the claim side, cases all over the country. And so it was getting me exposed to multiple jurisdictions, like literally coast to coast, getting to travel and attend mediations and trials. And I remember talking to like some peers that had also graduated around the same time. It was like, am I missing out? Like, I feel like I'm missing this piece of my career. And some of the feedback I got was like, well, no, not really. Because once you filed a motion, you filed 1,000 of them, and getting exposures to multiple jurisdictions, like all around the country, that's sort of unique. And so I landed on, okay, I'm going to kind of stick this path. I've got 5 years in the industry already. Let me just build out and see where I go. Initially, I thought I wanted to do like IP work, because I took a lot of IP courses. But just, again, where the market was, it kind of just wanted to have a job. And I knew steady industry, even in a recession, everybody needs insurance. So I kind of rolled with it and said, well, I'm going to lean into it, and this will be my path.
Yeah. Jose, while I have you on here, I know the focus is Jacob today, but I am curious. So you haven't been on the podcast. Was this the path that you had intended to take, or did you kind of fall into it?
Oh, in the insurance defense industry, not so much. But as a lawyer, yes, because growing up as a kid in Los Angeles, I always had to translate for my parents everywhere we went. Pay a bill to go anywhere. Something came in the mail. So they would always tell my mom, mostly, she was a single mom. She was like, you have to become a lawyer, but I'm not abogado, so you can help us in the future. So I always had that in mind. I went to UCLA, political science majors, but my first job, even as a law clerk, I worked for the city attorney's office doing all civil defense for the city, defending a lot of slip and falls and accident cases, a lot of First Amendment cases, interestingly, because before 9/11, you had a lot of these organizations soliciting donations at the airport at LAX, like the Hare Krishna. So the city passed the law, and that we were in litigation in the Ninth Circuit. I think that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the city had lost on the First Amendment grounds. Then when 9/11 hit, all that went out the door, and the little court said, yeah, you can do whatever you want at the airport now. So yeah, I mean, always that. But I then, from the city attorney's office, the partner here, Mark Zimmet, he had worked there. So he just made a call there and said, hey, any good clerks? And my name came up, and I've been with them ever since, 21 years now.
Oh, wow.
And it's just been growing. We merged with Cruiser Mitchell in 2016. I like it. You know, I love it. It is different, though. We get young associates, and you're reporting, dealing with adjusters. You have your client, but it's a tripartite relationship. Mm-hmm. So it's just different. And the billing, which yeah. Lawyer in the world, but if you don't get your hours in,
you don't get paid. So I'm curious that Jacob, since like you've had experience handling claims nationwide, and during that time, like when you're learning and you're seeing all these claims nationwide, were there certain, and I know what jurisdictions, I hear this a lot, but were there certain ones that you hated being in or you knew they were super problematic? I mean, I hear like California is one of the ones that always comes up on my end. California, Texas, and New York and Philadelphia. So I'm curious what your impression was.
I would describe them as difficult states so as not to offend people from those states living there and listening. Florida is, I mean, I think everybody knows Florida is a difficult state, and they passed some reform recently that I think will help it a lot and hopefully help carriers do business better. Louisiana is another, you know, notoriously difficult state. But then even within certain states, like in Texas, there's some jurisdictions like everywhere else, right, that you especially don't want to be in. Bexar County, anything along the border. California, I never saw and felt like was a difficult venue. I enjoyed California and still kind of feel that way because I know there are more challenging jurisdictions. Cook County, Illinois is another one that everybody knows is not a good place to be if you're a defendant. New York, never really kind of enjoyed it. Yeah, it was difficult, but can't say I had things go terrible in the cases I had there. And a lot of it, even in the most difficult states, though, right, it comes back to if you've got the right defense firm as a partner, then you're going to get a desirable outcome, even if it's not as good as it might be in a different venue. So for me, that was always key, is knowing, having that good firm that I can rely on that's going to tell me, look, don't pay me to defend this case. You really need to settle it because it's a losing battle. That's where I saw most of my success, was just being able to really have good defense firms and knowing who to call when I had a question come up.
One thing, though, I've found that often comes up is a client that I would work with, the sticker shock associated with some of the jurisdictions. Sometimes you explain it like, look, like this is in Philadelphia or this is in Queens. And with that, there's just an inflated sticker price to it. But sometimes it gets difficult to navigate and portray that because you're like, I'm not trying to inflate the numbers. It's just here, you might just see these inflated numbers. Is that something that you would notice with some of these more difficult jurisdictions when you're working with your outside counsel, like conveying that sort of information?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because you could say, oh, well, Washington State, this type of case, you know, a fracture or back surgery is going to be worth X. But in another Bexar County, Cook County, you know, you're going to add 25-30% for a variety of reasons. Cost of living, jurors look at numbers differently. Social inflation, obviously, is the big thing right now. Part of it, though, on the carrier side, if you're riding in multiple states, to me, it's the carrier's job to know the venues that they're in and know what those exposures are. It shouldn't be a terrible sticker shock. If you've been around riding long enough, then you should at least have some sort of knowledge about where your insureds are, what sorts of cases they can have. And then it shouldn't be as big of a sticker shock unless it's just a carrier that, okay, this is sort of a one-off where we generally don't have our insureds in this area and they either got a job or a contract position or they got a load that they needed to go out this way. And then you might have a little bit of pushback to say, well, wait a second, this isn't what we're normally dealing with. But then I come back to you, okay, well, we're relying on you guys to give us that information, you know, give us some verdict search or give us a tool so that we can maybe help understand, like, do we need to take this to a mock jury? Do we need to do something that helps us show, okay, here's why we're on the path that we're on. It's us telling you we've got all the research, but we can go a little bit further. If you really think it's a case to try, let's maybe think of those creative solutions to help get an achievable result.
Yeah.
Even if you got to spend a little bit more up front to get there.
Yeah. I think the key, though, is the partnering with the right counsel who really understand where the case is sitting to give you the best assessment of what that exposure might look like for you. But I wanted to fast forward a little bit to where you are now. And also just because when you and I talked on the phone, I think I could have talked to you for like an hour asking questions about the type of cases that you see and just Qualitas as in a company, because you are a Mexican-based insurance company, right?
Yeah, so our parent company is Qualitas Compañía de Seguros, based out of Mexico City. This is their 30th year in operations, and so they're a very large, wonderful company in Mexico. And 10 years ago, they started U.S. operations, and the idea was to support those trucks that are with our parent company insured in Mexico, but then come to the US, because obviously we import a lot of goods from Mexico, wanting to capture that market. And so that was the company was born out of that idea. And that's what we do today. A little bit of domestic trucking, and the book has shifted a little bit just through the natural course of the market. And so we do focus heavily on those Mexican plated vehicles coming into the US all along the border. Some will just go locally to kind of trade zones. Others will go 1,000, 1,500 miles. Just kind of depends on the load, like any trucking operations. So we do have this dual side of the business where we work with our agent partners in Mexico, who, you know, refer the business to our agents here in the U.S. And so it is a really interesting operation. It's sort of a niche within a niche of commercial trucking. We'll have the challenges of our driver being a Mexican citizen. There's an accident, then they'll go home. We have to work with our customers to make sure we're getting the information we need, allowing us to inspect trucks. And so our team is made up of a handful of wonderful bilingual staff to help kind of communicate on both sides. And so we explain the process, because claims in Mexico, obviously very much different than in the US. So we have to provide that sort of education and explanation of okay, here's why we need you to be involved. We need to make sure we can contact you even a couple of years down the line. So it's definitely unique. We work very closely with our parent company, who's been a wonderful support for us. I'm an advocate for what we're trying to achieve. And so this year is this month, actually March is our 10th anniversary of the company here in the U.S. And they operate in a couple of other countries as well, Costa Rica, Peru, Colombia. So like, I think we're five total countries. And so we're just a standalone subsidiary, fully owned by our parents.
And I read recently, just last week, that Mexico became the number one trading partner with the United States, surpassing China. So I assume the business has grown. And I've also seen my sister owns some land in Mexico, and there's a lot of infrastructure going on, projects, roads, bridges. I remember when we were kids, my mom's from Nayarit, so we would drive every summer. And we had to pass this road called La Rumorosa. Mm-hmm. And it's this road in the mountains. It's so scary. And it's one way. And you have big trucks coming. Whoa. And you look over the edge and you do see trucks that have actually are just there that have gone over. But I hear.
That's wonderful.
Well, back then, this is the 80s. Now I hear that the La Rumorosa is two roads separate, and it's really nice. And they're building a train, a big train that goes through parts of Mexico. So the infrastructure and the investments I think they've done is really good. Yeah.
So it's that road. It does still exist. It goes from Tijuana to Mexicali, kind of runs parallel to I-10. And it's still, I call it fun because I love twisty roads. I wanted to do it on a motorcycle, but it takes you through the pass, and it's still a fun road. I mean, it certainly has its I guess scary parts, but I'm all for a road trip. So I had the pleasure of driving it last year.
Oh wow! And better so, though, right? Now it's
it's a solid, you know, it's a 2-lane road.
There you go.
Okay. Guardrails and it's safe, but certainly yeah. Back in the day, it was scary. Yeah, and there is that the train. I just read an article about the new. It's I don't know if it's high speed, but they're trying to expand sort of the train from the East Coast inland to help make transport people, you know, way more efficient. Yeah. So nice. Certainly, yeah, there's a lot happening. And I think as just the environment has shifted post COVID, I mean, trying to have things more relatively local as opposed to from China, certainly there's a lot of opportunity, a lot of potential. I mean, there's thousands upon thousands of trucks that cross into the U.S. every day across the total border, you know, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, California, but certainly California, Texas are definitely leading the ways with those crossings. Even down in deep South Texas, where I grew up, the Rio Grande Valley, there's a couple of new bridges that I didn't even realize were there. I was like, oh, wow, like that's a crossing now. That used to just be like non-existent or it wasn't as big. So the infrastructure down there has drastically increased and made a lot of those areas. I mean, the Rio Grande Valley has always been a huge, huge area, but in part because of that growth and what we're importing, I think it's blown up in a great way for those regions. Of course, it brings its problems as well, right? You get more congestion, more traffic and all those fun things.
Yeah. Right. And then with congestion and traffic, you're probably seeing a rise in incidents and then right. stabilizing claims.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that, though. While you're a subsidiary of the parent company, that's a Mexican-based company, you have drivers that are based in Mexico, and there's probably some, there's definitely language barriers and things like that happen, and just different regulations, I imagine, between Mexico and the U.S. So how do you kind of navigate that with how a claim is handled when you have a Mexican citizen driver coming over, getting into whatever incident, say in Texas? It's like a legal problem blowing up in my mind, because you're in Texas, you have an international driver, you have like a US-based company, but then you have a Mexican.
a law school exam, right?
Yeah. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah. So, I mean, it starts with when the claim is first reported. We have the staff that will intake team that sets up claims are fully bilingual. So when that driver calls us to report the claim, they know they're going to speak with somebody who can communicate with them. All of our adjusters, and that team is in Tijuana. All of our adjusters are obviously US based. And so we do have a mix of bilingual adjusters. But even for those that aren't, we have another support team that's bilingual who will do our translation, assistance. And so they'll help not only us, but our defense attorneys that need to get involved early on. And even if our defense counsel or whoever we're working with, the associate, if they're not bilingual, we will have that same person sort of partner to just have the communication set up so that we can still get all the information that we need, where were they coming from, how long they were on the road, get all the documentation. When all these trucks come into the U.S., they're inspected by the DOT, right? So they meet all the inspection requirements that any other truck coming in the U.S. would need to meet. And so they understand, the drivers understand, and the companies understand that there are these regulations that these trucks and drivers have to abide by. And it sort of starts with that DOT inspection. And then we do have like risk management services where we will go out and sort of educate and explain, here's what's going to happen when you cross. Here's what the inspection looks like. Here's what they look for. And here's things you need to make sure your trucks are doing in good working order, good maintenance, all the same things that any US-based truck would need to have. So because we're on both sides, we have people on both sides, risk management in Mexico, and then we have our staff here. So it really is a partnership where we're making sure we're communicating the same things like you would with the US company, just adding to your point that extra layer of, well, yes, you're international, you're from Mexico, you're in another country, it's an international sort of situation, but there are those mechanisms in place to make sure that we can get what we need, get the claim handled and resolved, and then still have that cooperation if we need to. It's worked. It's been very successful, and you got to develop a lot of trust with your insured, with the agent, so that way they know if there's a problem, they can call us and we get the situation resolved.
Yeah, and I have noticed that with Spanish-speaking drivers, even the cases we handle here in California, where between the driver and the company itself, first they only speak Spanish. So when you call them, they say, well, no, this is tiene que ver con la compañía, nothing to do with me. And you have to explain to them in Spanish, no, si lo están demandando a usted, directamente as the driver. And they finally get it. But a lot of times you have to build that rapport with them. And really, if you don't speak Spanish, it's difficult to. I translate here at the firm a couple of times. And a lot of times they'll see the name. They're like, yeah, I'll let Jose handle it. A lot of times some of these drivers are just normal people, but they're not tech savvy. So they don't have emails. They have cell phones. A lot of the correspondence is by text. You text or WhatsApp, WhatsApp.
Yeah.
It is a one little extra layer, where normally we handle hundreds of trucking cases, and the majority of them are English speaking, but when you have those only Spanish ones, and then you have to explain it to the adjuster, this is what your driver is saying now, because they never really got interviewed them in Spanish to get their side of the story. So,
and then for the driver that's the Mexican citizen, their perspective of like how claims work is different because it runs so different in Mexico. In Mexico, with our company at least, the police don't go to the scene generally. The insurance company will. And in Mexico, they have this wonderful network of adjusters, field adjusters, where you're in an accident. Generally, a company adjuster will show up at the scene. Wow. And a lot of claims are settled at the scene. They'll write estimates at the scene. If somebody's got to go to the doctor, they'll arrange for some of that. But you don't have, the damages are just drastically different. A fatality in Mexico is generally you're paying a year's salary for that region. So that could be $25,000, $30,000. You don't have punitive pain and suffering. I mean, it's just those damages that we're used to don't exist. And so the claims are dealt with within a few days, maybe a few weeks, if you do have to go to court and resolve your more severe claims. But that cycle time is so much slower. So if an adjuster comes to a scene, it's like, okay, well, now it's done. To your point, the driver's like, well, now it's on the company. Here, yeah, it's different because we do have all those things. And so their framework for what a claim is and how it's handled is drastically different. And so that's part of the education we have to explain. We need you involved. We need you to give us a statement. And there's also that fear here of like, well, if the police come, what's going to happen? And so that's certainly a real fear and a valid fear in some cases. And then sometimes a driver will think, oh, well, the police will turn it into the insurance company. It's like, no, you still have to report it. I was like, well, I reported it to the police. Like, isn't that enough? It's like, well, no, you still got to get it to us. So that's where those, again, the education that we have to provide constantly is always there, because with that driver's, his perspective is just different.
Yeah.
And do you ever find too that even with the police investigation, that there could be some prejudice and animosity towards, like, that's a fear probably for the driver as well, having the police involved, like, no, I'm working, I'm here, I'm not here because I'm not supposed to be here, I'm supposed to be here. And I imagine there's a lot of anxiety attached to that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's more or less of like the fear of like, am I supposed to be here or not? Because I mean, obviously they know they are and they're working, but it's really getting the officer to understand their version of what happened. And so if it's a merging incident and the driver's trying to explain what he was doing, well, he can't. And so we've seen situations where, yeah, the police fault our driver, but we might not be able to overcome that because it's already, the driver said, well, that's not how it happened. What we have had good luck with is now you're seeing more and more vehicles and 18-wheelers, of course, with cameras.
Yeah.
And so those can be the saving grace when, you know, it's a disputed accident. But usually if it's on video, I mean, if the police officer can see it there at the scene, even if there's a communication barrier, that can be of extreme help. Or even if they got it wrong and we've got that video, that, as we all know, is going to be super helpful, whether it's good or bad for us. I mean, we just want to know up front.
Right.
And so we're starting to see more and more of those. And that is having an impact where, okay, yeah, we know we don't need to fight this one. We got to work to resolve it as soon as possible. Or, yeah, you know, the video shows what it shows and this driver did nothing wrong. So that, I think, technology, incorporating technology is going to be a big help to, I don't want to say save the driver, but just save everybody from themselves and trying to, you know, have disputes that we shouldn't be disputing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. To your point, Megan, I have a case, recent case, where our driver, it was a merger, and his position was, well, they merged and they sideswiped me, and the person didn't even know they were hit. So he actually followed them for a few miles and got them to pull over, say, hey, you hit me. But when the police showed up, because he couldn't speak English, the police reports 100% liability on the truck driver, because the other driver said, you know, it was his fault. And he told me on the phone, in Spanish, he just said, I couldn't convey what happened to the officer. So he believed the other side. And that's one where we had to take depositions to get down, and we're settling the case. But still, that does happen. I've seen it.
Now you have probably a negative police report that you have on your hands that even an unsavvy plaintiff's attorney is going to is going to wave that one around. So
yeah, I had to explain to him in Spanish. I said, the police report says you were 100% at fault. He goes, pero why would I follow them, stop them? And then I asked him, but why did you do that? And he said, because they hit me. You know, like who's going to fix my truck? I needed to get them. So it makes sense. But yeah, you're right. Now we have to deal with the police report.
Yeah.
So it happens. Yeah.
So I also imagine, do you have, or sometimes have to deal with like drivers that go missing though? Because I mean, look, this happens just US-based companies that drivers go missing, but now you have Mexican-based drivers that go missing. Then we have a case that's gets filed in litigation 2 years later, and now you have to try to track down this individual. I'm sure that you see that more frequently than you want.
Yeah, it happens, which is why it's crucial. You know, we educate our adjusters to push to get statements as just part of your workflow and maintain that contact information. Fortunately, we work with a lot of sophisticated entities on yeah. with our partners on the other side. So they can be very helpful. And even if a driver moves on to something else, being able to locate. But that is, yeah, the, when those situations happen, then we have to factor that in to say, you know, we thought this was a case we could defend. Our driver's MIA. We've got a corporate representative who can talk about the company. But without that driver, we know we can't defend what would otherwise and should be, you know, a case. And then sometimes you do have to overpay. Or pay more than you otherwise would. But that, I mean, again, that's if you're in commercial trucking, like that's the risk. Just like if you're insuring grocery stores and the teenager that was supposed to check the floor, you know, okay, he went off and is now in college four states away and he has no desire to come back and participate. So it's sort of like similar issues, just in a different trade. And you work through them and hope for the best and try to do your due diligence is the best thing you can do.
Part of it too is messaging the training that should be trickling down the lines for like the partners. Yeah, you need to train your employees to this is how they should respond to an accident. And again, companies have protocols and some are good and some aren't so good. But if you have a Mexican-based company and their claim process is much different from the US claim process, that they might not document the claims in the same way, because if it's handled that quickly on the scene like you were talking about, they're not thinking that, oh well, this is going to come up 2 years down the line and you need all this paperwork in order to help defend your claim. So it's like a group messaging that, like, from your adjusters down to your insured partners, and the training that you have to kind of discuss with them, like, this is the training that these employees need to have, even though typically the claims you see are handled on the spot. So almost.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a situation come in last week where this accident happened in October of last year, and our first notice was a lawsuit, and we all kind of looked at that like, what happened? Like, where did the ball get dropped? But part of that is us as a carrier just needing to actually be proactive and go educate the agents to get that message. And so this year we have a huge initiative to get our staff, my litigation manager, partnered with one of my managers in Tijuana, are literally going to go to Juarez across from El Paso, Nuevo Laredo across from Laredo, mm-hmm. to meet with our agents and set up trainings and talk about, give presentations and go through these case studies to help say, here's what we need to do. Here's the process. Here's the workflow of claims in the U.S. Let's make sure we're educating. And part of it, I think, is just growing pains. You've got more trucks coming across, you know, newer businesses that maybe weren't having to deal with this on the regular, being involved in these situations. And we've got a lot of insurers who have been doing this and are wonderful about calling us from the scene when it happens. I guess for all the missteps, there's so many more wins that happen on a day-to-day basis. They don't bubble up and elevate to big things. So we know that messaging works. We know the education works. But I think the growth that's happening is really creating this need to just be more proactive and get out there and build, again, that trust and build those relationships with the agents, with the client, the insured, and everybody in between. So that way, it's all about having the right outcome, right? We want to pay what we owe and not play games. Games on those, but education has been the biggest push since I've joined, even before I joined, but we're just kind of trying to take it to the next level with our adjusters and everybody.
The education point is so key though too. Yeah. So you know very well, like you get that file, that one or two documents that should be there that aren't there, or things that weren't done that should have been done. You know those are going to be not the smoking guns, but the corner pieces that are going to make, they're going to be big deals just because, and whether or not they were really a big deal or not, they're going to become that.
The safety check, right? And having those one or two key documents that you have them every other time, and then you don't have them this one time, and that's the time where you were in an accident, right? You know, your driver log isn't right, or you didn't, you know, you're 2 hours over where you should have been, or you parked because you were over hours in a no parking area, and then somebody comes and rear-ends you. I mean, there's so many issues that come up where that one little mistake. We had a situation where somebody had pulled off the road in front of a no parking sign because they were trying to check their load, and then somebody comes and, you know, they get rear-ended. This is a wide patch of road where off the shoulder, there's probably 15 feet of space that goes, I don't know, 300 yards long. And we did a Google search looking, you know, Google image history. 3 out of the 5 years when the Google camera's going by, you see an 18-wheeler pulled off in front of this no parking sign. Right off the highway. And so it's like, okay, you know, everybody's doing it wrong. And it's like, okay, you had to pull off. We get that. But did you have to pull off at that spot, like at that moment. Yeah, those, it's the little things that, does it take a case from zero to multi-millions of dollars? I mean, it shouldn't, but we know that it does. Yeah. Because we have to take into account, how's a jury going to see that? I was at a CE seminar last week, and it was a pedestrian crossing the road versus an 18-wheeler. And the pedestrian was clearly jaywalking. She was unfortunately blind and not sure why she was by herself. But you see on the dash cam it coming, and they're saying, you know, we did a mock jury on this, and it was 50-50. Should the driver have slowed down or let off the brake, or should she have been crossing the road where we shouldn't have? Logic says we shouldn't have been crossing the road right there. But then you get all those other intangible factors, and it becomes a case where if you're the driver, it's like, what did I do wrong? I'm going on the road at the speed limit. How am I at fault for this? But we then have to make that business decision of right. Do we want to fight it and spend the money?
And also for that particular example there too, had they slowed down, could they have even stopped? Would the speed plus the load allowed them time to even stop by the time that they noticed this person crossing the road? Like, probably not.
Yeah, exactly. But we know there's going to be jurors who are going to, you know, not care. And they're going to say they still should have stopped. Forget logic. This person killed this individual, and they should have to pay something.
Yeah. And you have a very sympathetic, any plaintiff is sympathetic, but you have a blind person crossing a road that's.
Yeah, it's and I mean, look, as a human, right? Like that's a horrible situation,
yes.
Right? You just and unfortunately, our job is to assess those things and put value on things that are very difficult to value. But that's why we're here, right? That's why we have jobs.
You know, and that's I think you and I discussed this too. Like talking about that brings up the whole nuclear verdict, and when you deal with trucks. The nuclear verdicts is something that it's always, I think, in the forefront of your mind, particularly in certain jurisdictions that I think you see more often. And that's a consideration, though, too. Like a case like that, that's a nuclear verdict potential fact pattern. Yeah. You have to be cognizant of that.
Agreed. It's definitely at the front of everybody's mind, right? And we, you know, our limits, we generally write 750 or a million. Most of our insureds don't carry umbrella coverage. And that's another challenge, right? Because we know it doesn't take much for that to go above that. But even if you did have $25 or $100 million limits, like it goes into the analysis. You don't want your insured to face that sort of verdict, even if they've got enough insurance coverage. Like that's just a challenging situation to be in. But then on the flip side, it's like, well, how do you change that outcome? How do you know if we as carriers are not wanting to try cases out of that fear, how do we overcome that? And kind of, I don't want to say educate the juries, but where do you go in and say, okay, this is one you got to fight. You know, we know it could be bad. You got to be very selective in picking those cases. But collectively, I mean, if more carriers would start doing that, then maybe you sort of chip away in some of these venues where there's just this big fear. And I mean, I can say I'm guilty of that, where I'm like, yeah, we probably don't want to try a case in this venue because the risk is not worth it. And we want to make sure we're doing the best thing for our insured, which is definitely not having them be subject to a verdict that they shouldn't be faced with.
Yeah, it's such a challenge, though, too, because you don't want to. There's certain cases you don't want to seem like you're running scared. You know, I practice a lot in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia could be terrible. In the last 2 weeks, they had like $1 billion verdict and a $200 million verdict. You also sometimes you have to treat them those cases to kind of like one-off. So too, just because there's that one or two that hit doesn't mean you have to run scared from every other one, but it is indicative of how it could go, and you need to inform all the players like, by the way, this just happened.
Yeah, I had a great leader in an organization one time where we did have a verdict that we didn't expect. Fortunately, we had a high low, but he was the first to say, look, let's not let this case dictate how we handle future cases. He viewed it very much the same way. This is a one-off, but we don't want to certainly run fearful just because of this one case, even though we know the plaintiff attorneys are going to be jumping up and down, shaking this huge verdict. And that's the right approach, right? I mean, that's certainly, you want to be pragmatic and find those cases, and they got to be the right one. In 2022, we did take two cases to trial in California. One was in LA, and we did get two defense verdicts. But there are ones you look at, you're like, well, yeah, you should have won those. Like they're we did nothing wrong, and unfortunately, you know, the jury believed it. But then at what cost, though? What did we spend to sort of get that result? Yeah. That's always the balance of, could we have settled it sooner in 1 or 2 years versus letting it go for 5 or 6 years? Sometimes being able to define what is a win in this situation, taking taking all things into consideration, costs, expenses, verdicts, time, effort on the part of the insured. Sometimes if we're saying, yeah, we're going to fight this one, but the insured's like, okay, how long is this going to take? Well, 5 years. You're telling me I've got to deal with this for 5 years. I've got a business to run. That can be all things to take into account when you want to make these decisions.
Well, yeah. And it's something we talk about in our office a lot. I could see Jose nodding his head, like exactly that. Like, what is the win? What, how do you define the win? And I'm sure for those cases that you took to trial, like those were ones that it was decided the win is this is what we need to do. And we're okay with the spend because this is where it needs to go. But not every case is like that. And you have to make an individual decision. It's like, what's the win for this case and this client or this insured? Because I'm sure there's like, just like that, some insureds that are adamant. They don't want to go to trial. They don't, especially if they only have coverage up to 750 or a million and they could potentially be exposed. Might not be something they wish to do.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's and explaining, look, maybe you didn't do anything wrong in this situation, but these are the realities. I mean, this is, and just laying it out for them, right? And that's any client just saying, here's what could happen. Here's what might unlikely to happen. But if what we're saying is going to happen 2 out of 10 times, and that's going to put you way over, then we have to give that its fair weight, even though it seems unlikely.
Yeah, yeah. We had a trial that we defense, but it was 3 years, a month, 28 days in trial. So a month and a half. Yeah. And I thought, great. And it wasn't unanimous, you know, civil. So it was like 10-2 that we did nothing wrong. And I thought the adjuster would be thrilled. And afterwards, I wrote to him, said, great, we won and nothing back. So I decided to call him and said, hey, did you get my email? We won. He goes, yeah, I saw that. What's the matter? And he said, well, he just tells me, you know, you couldn't have settled it earlier. So it's like, whoa. So it depends. I think we do try, at least our philosophy here is try, you know, if we can early, reasonably try to get them resolved. But then obviously there's some that you need to try. And that's, you know, that's okay too. But if you don't at least give that, you know, initial call, I've had cases where I get the file and it's been pre-litigation for about a year and they just never received a demand and never really asked for one. So just pick up the phone and you call counseling, like, what are you looking for? It's not that much. And they're like, oh, we'll take 25,000. So I'm like, oh, that's a lot. Knowing in my mind, yeah, it's probably don't happen. But I'm like, God, that much? It's going to be tough, but let me go see what I can do. And then you knock them out early. But then I have one right now that's been a couple of years, and it's a little fender bender. And at the mediation, the plaintiff didn't even recognize his own client on the Zoom mediation. He didn't know. He didn't submit a brief. He just didn't know anything about the case. He said that our truck was 3 times the weight of their truck when actually we were driving. It was a commercial vehicle, but it was a little AC truck and they were driving a big Toyota Tacoma. So their truck was, he didn't, but he wants $1 million or nothing. And it's no further demand and cut off communication. And so there are some like that one that I think would need to probably, you know, be tried. But I think that's the minority though. I do think the majority of cases you can access early. And there's a lot of plaintiff attorneys. We had a few here that were defense attorneys, started their own plaintiff firm. So I always call them and say, hey, you know, so-and-so, what do you think about this? Oh, no, he's just, oh, and he hired this expert. No, just go ahead, offering this. I'm like, really? And, it, you know, a lot of plaintiffs, they want to spend their time on bigger cases. You know, mm-hmm. if they can settle a few reasonably early and reasonably, they'll do that just to keep, you know, a flow coming in. So, you have to try everyone early and then report back.
Well, yeah, sometimes too, it's not worth their costs to put, to invest in that case. They'd rather invest in the larger cases. Like, it's not worth them to like pay an expert $5,000-$6,000 on a case that's not worth a lot. They'd rather just have that early phone call with you and be like, okay, so what can we do? 25? Well, I don't know. 25 might be hard, but yeah. That's a lot. But I think one of the other challenges too, when you have the insureds, you have a case that their driver wasn't at fault and they do drag on because say you have a non-responsive counsel, or usually it's in those cases, it's a non-responsive counsel or their client is just looking for too much. And then you get the insureds who get frustrated. rightfully so, but it's hard to be like, look, we understand that you may not have done anything wrong, but then that makes it increasingly hard to resolve it. One, if I can't get a hold of counsel, they're not responding, or they're not working up this file. Like, it's hard to find that middle ground and resolve it for something that makes sense. You know, still, you don't want to overpay just to get out of something early.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. How many times have we gone to a mediation and the night before or at mediation, they drop another $300,000 of medical?
Yeah.
Or, you know, or more, or you find out at mediation, oh, they're scheduled for surgery next week. And it's like, well, where was any of this in the discovery? Like, why? And that tried tactic, you almost have to like take that into account when you're evaluating this. Is it, you know, okay, here's what we have, but what are they going to show up with? Even though it have to almost completely dismiss it, because yeah, it's, if this was serious, you would have spoken up about this before. Yeah, I mean, overcoming like those tactics, like that becomes the challenge. I mean, for a carrier, it's, you know, how do you evaluate a case when you don't know what you don't know? Yeah. The ones that will keep treating for the 3 to 5 years throughout the course of litigation, even, you know, up until trial, and those become hard to resolve. And then you're kind of forced, right? If they're going to force your hand, then so be it.
Yeah.
The biggest push is that we've been trying to do is, if we can talk to a claimant right when we get a claim, before they've even talked to a lawyer, which, you know, hey, go get a lawyer, that's your right. But having at least an initial conversation, have you been to a doctor? How are you doing? And we want to get your car taken care of. And, oh, you know, I haven't gone to a doctor. We got an appointment in a few weeks or next week or something. And then just building a rapport to say, okay, well, let's talk. We see the photos. This seems, no one wants to be in an accident, but fortunately, you know, everybody seems to be okay. Can we try to come to a resolution and make those sorts of direct offers? I mean, that happens a lot too. And so it prevents, you know, we see all the billboards, right? Don't trust the insurance companies. I mean, right. We've got a job to do. They've got a job to do. And if somebody is comfortable enough to say, look, you know, yeah, I'm not hurt, or this was a minor thing, I think most people can be in a car accident and walk away without a blip. My brother was in an accident back in December, and his truck was totaled with really bad rear end injury, and his son was in there, and his wife, and they were like, you know, we're a little sore, but I'm okay. And I've seen those accidents where people get surgeries and 780,000 in medicals, and he's like, you know, I'm fine. Like, I'm mad about my car, but we're okay. And the car did its job in protecting us. And so that's, I think, some of the common sense, where it's like, cars can absorb an impact. They can, that's their job. It's the car's job, right? It crumples so that we don't. And there is a certain threshold where everybody will be okay, for the most part, of course, exceptions. But yeah, I mean, you know, any creative ways that we can go about getting positive outcomes, I think carriers are getting creative. I think we all need to, and discuss it. I mean, you know, whether it's at conferences or whatever groups, in venues like this, forums like this, where we can kind of come together to share those ideas, I think that's a good thing. And it's going to do nothing but help us stay educated, stay in the know, and make sure we're all sort of aware of what the issues are that we need to be talking about.
Yeah. The crumpled car photo too is like, it's such a... Because it looks so much worse. And it's not to say that there aren't bad accidents, but like sometimes it's like a tactic to make it look worse than it actually is. It's like, there's been a lot of safety testing on these vehicles. Like,
yeah. The crash test dummies were probably okay.
So Jacob, we were just about out of time, but I don't want to end this without asking you this. I ask this of pretty much every guest I have on here. Looking back on your career and knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your younger Jacob, as mm-hmm. you're a young claims adjuster before you go to law school? What sort of advice would you give yourself?
I'm going to preface this question so this is my second podcast. The first one that I did was actually where I finished undergrad at University of Texas at Arlington. And there were, as part of a freshman English course, students were required to reach out to somebody that is in a field you might be interested in going into. And so I had two very wonderful 18, 19 year old students ask basically just that, like, what advice would you give to people wanting to go and thinking about insurance or a career in law? And for me, I mean, it was stay open-minded. Like, I approached law school, I knew a couple areas I didn't want to get into, criminal, family, like I knew probably wouldn't be my interest, but everything else I stayed open to pursuing, and just being aware enough to know that there's a lot I don't know. For insurance, I think it's it doesn't have like that sort of like sex appeal. Like it's not a very exciting, it's insurance, right? It's kind of boring and you sit in a room and read papers all day and contracts. But I do think it's a healthy career. I think it does have its challenges on a day to day. I mean, we're all 20 year-ish plus or minus mark, I think, on this call. So something about it has kept us in it. Yes, it's a job, right? It's a paycheck, but it doesn't have to be your passion and you don't have to sort of live to work, but I think it does allow you to work to live and it gives you the opportunity to meet a lot of great people, work with people in different departments that you aren't aware of, risk management, underwriting. It's literally international and you never know who you're going to meet on the next call or it could lead to another opportunity. It could lead to a connection. And so from a really diverse sense of like what you could be touching in this industry, to me, that's what sort of kept me engaged. I mean, even if as an adjuster, one week I'm in New York, next week I'm in Florida, next week you're in San Francisco, or it's one day you're talking to somebody in one place or another and just getting to know about their experience. So just diversity would probably be the best thing I would describe this industry. And I would probably tell my younger self to just don't give up on it, like stick with it, because it's worth pursuing. It can provide a great quality of life. There's a lot of opportunity out there, as we all know in the industry. We're all sort of poaching from each other, whether it's lawyers or adjusters. It's something that you can always look to do something else within the field and be pretty happy. And that's kind of been my consensus in talking to people that are just starting out, you know, maybe 5 years, and then those that are 20 years my senior that have done it for 40 years.
And if you just even look at your own career progression, like you started off as adjuster and then you go to law school and then you're at a broker, you're at an insurance company. And now like you're VP of claims. So now you're in management positions. Like, and then meanwhile, probably like you start off working in like doing premises kind of claims and it grows and it evolves. So it's not boring. That's for sure.
Right. Agreed. Yeah. Definitely keeps you on your toes. It keeps you learning. You can't stop learning. And that's the other part of it, is if you want to continue to test your knowledge, definitely having to continue to evolve.
Yeah. Sometimes I get like mad when I hear people say, oh, you know, don't become a lawyer. I'm like, I think that's bad advice because like there's certain parts about this job that aren't the best. Yes, maybe give some warning and it isn't all like palm trees and rainbows and gumdrops, but like it also provides a lot of opportunity for it to do a lot and lots of different things. I don't like the blanket, like, oh yeah, I don't want my kid to be a lawyer. I'm like, why? Why not? You made a good life for yourself.
The funny question I always get is, why isn't your name up in the billboards? I'm a defense attorney. All I do is defense.
And one time my mom's like, you're an ambulance chaser. I'm like, I'm really not, but like, I don't think you understand what I do. In any event, Jacob, thank you so much for joining me. Jose, thank you for coming on too for your first podcast. I appreciate the time that you spent with us today and sharing what your company does and the claims that you have. And I love being able to talk about trucking and, you know, commercial accidents and excess verdicts and all of that. So thank you again for coming on. And of course, to our listeners out there, if you like what you hear, please like and subscribe to Claims Never Sleep. You can find us on your favorite streaming platform as well as YouTube. Thank you.